Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years' War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered.
Hold on a minute. What's this? Well, this, history friends, is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered, and you're about to listen to the first collaboration episode of this extravaganza of ours. So, if you've no idea what that means, it basically means it's sort of a free-flowing, conversational, roughly planned out, roughly sketched, throwing caution to the wind, talk episode kind of thing, except with a podcaster about a certain topic that they hopefully know a good bit about. Maybe not as much as Sean, but we can't all be infallible. Thanks very much for listening, guys. Today, on the podcast collaboration, we have Travis J. Dow. We're very happy to have him, because Travis is one of those guys that seems to just breathe, or sneeze, or exist in general, and a podcast appears, a wild podcast appears. I ask him to list off his extensive numbers of podcasts at the beginning. Travis is very fortunate to also be fluent in German, so because of that, he's dipped into the German podcast world. And let's just say it's a bit crazy in its own way. But he's kept very, very busy, as I'm sure you can imagine, what with History of Germany, History of Alchemy, Bohemicon, The Secret Cabinet, which he's translated from German, by the way. He's a machine. I thought I was bad, but if I have no life and I'm doing this, he must have minus one life, or minus 10 lives, or minus 9 lives. Whatever it is, he's mad. And he deserves to be listened to. So that's why he's on the podcast. He's also a good friend of the podcast and a fellow Agora peer, or MP, or maybe not in the House of Lords, but he's a fellow Agora member. So it's nice to have people like them on, because community and encouragement and all that jazz. So yeah, I hope you'll enjoy this first collaboration episode. And I hope you'll remember that all of this has been brought to you because, well, we're 5 years old, guys. And I felt it was time to give you a gift to signify all the fun times we've had together. So I really hope you're enjoying what we're giving you so far. I mean, we're only just into it, really. This is the first one. You've just heard remastered Franco-Prussian, hopefully. And hopefully you think it's better than the original. But either way, here we are. And we won't be stopping just with this. We'll be keeping on going, keeping on trucking. You won't be able to believe your eyes with the amount of stuff coming towards you. But yeah, let me know what you think of this. It's the first one, so either way, you're going to get more because the schedule's set up that way. But still, do let me know. And let Travis know as well. Check him out at podcastnick.com. That's podcastnik.com. He's a good guy, and I'm sure you'll agree, he knows a heck of a lot about doing podcasts. Just a reminder, guys, go to WDFpodcast.com and you can see there all the different ways to support the podcast. Everything from being fit, spreading the word, simply listening to an episode, or buying a t-shirt, ordering the book, that kind of thing. You can also become a patron and support When Diplomacy Fails well into the future and get some goodies in return for your wonderful, much appreciated service. So yeah, thanks very much, guys, for stopping by, and I hope you enjoy our first collaboration episode of When Diplomacy Fails Remastered. Let's get to it. I will now take you to, well, a conversation between myself and Travis J. Dow. Thanks and enjoy. So, on the podcast for the very first collaboration episode, the very first official collaboration episode, today we have Travis J. Dow from, well, a great number of podcasts. How's it going there, Travis?
Good, good. And thanks for having me on. Any excuse to talk Bismarck and Franco-Prussian War. Good stuff.
Absolutely. I feel the exact same way. Take us through just a number of the podcasts. Actually, just give us a full list of the podcasts you do, including translation work and otherwise, just so people get a feel for who Travis is.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. So I should probably mention that they're, because I'm not going to list all the individual sites or anything, but they're all on podcastnik.com, like podcast N-I-K, like Sputnik kind of. It's actually like Czech for podcaster, but still, or it could be, I guess. Let's see, History of Germany, which I do in two languages. So that's two, I do, you know, it's 100% in English and 100% in German. People ask me like, how much is in German and how much is in English? I'm like, yes, both. Wow. It's two separate feeds. And then History of Alchemy and Bohemican are the first two I started. So that people might know me from there, because I've been doing those for like, we just rounded 4 years, I think, of History of Alchemy and Bohemican. Bohemican nice. Is about the Czech Republic. Prague, the Czech Republic, is where like alchemy and our love for Prague itself kind of intersects. Like I was a ghost tour guide and I just noticed there's a lot of tales of alchemists on the tours. And I'm like, what's even an alchemist, you know?
Yeah.
So that started my podcasting world. And then for History of Germany, because I do it in German, I did notice at the beginning that my German was getting pretty rusty. So just as practice, and because I love the show in German, I translated Das Geheime Kabinett into English as The Secret Cabinet. And that is like the weird tales from from history, like the ones that your history teacher wouldn't tell you about. Like the last episode was a short history of pornographic film.
I see.
And yeah, so just like all kinds of, the first episode was like Napoleon's penis.
Right.
It's not explicit language per se, but it's definitely, you know, Hitler's missing testicle and whether he even, yeah, oh. I mean, that, you know, that kind of thing. And it's just, yeah. Yeah, it has a lot of euphemisms in German, so I try to match. It is really good practice.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's just a lot of, that's a show I have a lot of fun on, The Secret Cabinet. And then I do, for a year now, I've been doing a show that I only do in German called Americana für euch. It's about the U.S. but I only do it in German. So that's that. And I do a show that now and then when I get around to, and I like, there's a topic burning on my mind that I want to do, and it's more of a collaborative thing, or will be a collaborative thing in future. But I just launched Africa a History like less than a year ago.
I saw that. Yeah,
that's like what I had in mind with that was like, okay, here's a feed, here's a platform, but it's not going to be just me. Like I want interviews, I want other podcasters, other, you know, that's going to be a group effort. But that's been really interesting too, and a lot of fun. That's probably about, I feel like I'm forgetting something, but that's
it's like remembering the names of all your children or something.
That's right. Yes. Podcast is Steve and Bob and yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well,
basically when I burn out, some people kind of take a break and you know, might just take a break of podcasting, go on a sabbatical. I start another show. I just, I'm tired of reading about alchemy for now. I'm going to read about Germany. But then later I'm like, oh boy, I'd love to just sit down and read a book on alchemy. So it all works out. Yep.
We're absolutely delighted to have you on and very excited to talk about the Franco-Prussian War because, I mean, it's been 5 years since I did the original episode. So I did accompany that with a talk episode with Sean, of course, and
anyone who listens to it will probably be able to tell, at least in some way, that it's been 5 years. It was a good while ago. But have you touched on the Franco-Prussian War much yourself in your own work?
I have. I'm way back. I'm in like the 12th or 13th century right now. So, and at a snail pace. So it'll probably be a couple years before I get there on the history of Germany. I've never gotten the chance to talk Bismarck yet. Then maybe in passing. Oh, we did on Bohemian. No, but that's not even Franco-Prussian. On the Deutsch-Deutscher Krieg, the German-German War, or I think we call it the Prussian-Austrian War.
Yeah,
that was all fought in the Czech Republic. So when I lived there, then Pete Coleman, he's my co-host on a couple shows. That's actually an adventure. He might launch a show on, because he's in a wheelchair, he's paraplegic, what it's like to live overseas. Like, he's from D.C. and Atlanta, and he's just a trooper in on Czech, like Prager, you know, cobblestone roads. Nothing's really accessible in the way we kind of have it by law in the States. So he's a trooper. And so he's going to do a show on, well, here's your travel guide. Even if you're just on crutches, or what you can expect, who you have to call, that kind of thing. And probably this will make it on there. Like, we went to a reenactment out in the field somewhere. I mean, you know, Königgrätz, Kralove in Czech, but it's often the Battle of Königgrätz.
Also known as the Battle of Sadova as well.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, we went out to there. And Czech reenactments, by the way, are amazing. They, this whole EU coalition, like, they all know each other.
Wow.
But whether it's World War II. So we were in Pilsen at the 70th, not to go too far off track. But, that's on YouTube. And we interviewed Helen Patton. And I was wearing my grandfather's uniform. But the liberation of Pilsen in World War II. The reenactors were just amazing. Like, all these American U.S. troops that had, they bought all their Jeeps or tanks or whatever in Belgium and, you know, got them running again. And they were driving them from who knows where to Pilsen. And it was just, yeah, fantastic. And the same goes for any era, like the Austro or Franco-Prussian or 19th century wars. They're just ready to go. They got their Russian troops and Austrian troops and, you know, even like the Hussite Wars. So you can tell, like, the different noble families, they'll have the Schwarzenberg flag it's just amazing. So they're like, they got this. Like, reenactments in the Czech Republic. Yes. Go do it. And there's enough battles that were fought in Prague. You can just go there by tram, like Bahora, towards the very beginning of the 30 Years' War and all that stuff. But not to get too far off track, that's probably on Bohemian. We've mentioned that. So not even Franco-Prussian, I don't think.
Wow.
We mentioned that aspect of we saw the Prussian troops fight the Austrian troops. And I went up to both of them and talked to them, and they were both Czech, but that was awesome. That's as close as I've gotten so far. Can't wait, by the way. Like, when I do finally get there in the history of Germany, like, it'll be, that's going to be a lot of fun.
I mean, you said you're in the 12th century or so. The unwrapping of the Holy Roman Empire in your History of Germany podcast must be a good bit of fun, because I've found it a great occupation of the podcast is to unwrap exactly what the Holy Roman Empire was.
All the drama. I'm like, pick a generation. Yes. There's always drama between emperor and pope. Pick it. So I had Steve Guerra on the show. Like, he's also an Agora affiliate. He's an Agora network member, and I had him on the show. Is like, what is the investiture controversy? And, you know, to break, like, what's the, you know, what was, tell me about the Great Schism and all that. Cause it's like, there's emperors putting popes in Vatican City. And then those popes are like anointing, you know, crowning the emperor, and like, it's, but then they hate each other. So all the intrigue it's every bit of every era of history has its own, or is interesting for its own reasons. But defining the Holy Roman Empire is neat, because it's like, if we take it from the beginning, this little event that happened right here, this won't be important for 200 years. But in 200 years, they're going to look back at this as precedence for this big battle or whatever. So keep, or, you know, civil war. So keep this in mind.
Sure.
Let's keep moving. You know, like, all that stuff's happening, which is, it becomes important until the early 19th century, like until the, you know, until the fall of the Holy Roman Empire. So
the thing that always interests me is how Prussia actually like rose out of the Holy Roman Empire. Like you had all the different states as well. And actually I got into the, like at the time, 5 years ago, I didn't really understand properly where Prussia came from. And I still it's
yeah.
Amazing story to wrap one's head around, but it was kind of self-evident in the Franco-Prussian War Talk episode, at least, because I studiously avoided it in the solo episode. But the fact that it managed to just bring itself out of, like, and distinguish itself as basically the second most important state in Germany, really, yeah. Apart from Austria, it's an incredible story.
Where I am in history, or at least a couple episodes previously, this was not even Germanic. This was Slavic territory. This was, you know, then the Saxon marches, like border territory, like here there be dragons kind of thing. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to over-exaggerate that. Of course, there was trade and this and that, but there's also like 30 years of war, like the Teutonic Orders and the, you know, after the Crusades and all this. And then like Prussia comes out of like, so who are even the Prussians? Like they're not yeah. even a Germanic people. You know, we got the Franks and the Saxons, and where are the Prussians? Oh, Prussians yeah, don't I exist know. Yet. What?
So this is the way I understand it. So the Teutonic Order basically founds it. Then they set up kind of Prussia as this kind of Protestant stronghold, essentially. And then they do well for a while. Then they lose to the Poles, and the Poles occupy it. And they essentially like partition Prussia between East and West, Royal and Ducal Prussia. And then yeah. the Elector of Brandenburg comes to have Ducal Prussia at some stage, but still under fealty to the Polish king. So he has to basically be a vassal to the Polish mm-hmm. king for the sake of Ducal Prussia. But then what happens is, which is funny because most people don't know, and it's a really important moment in history, but during the Swedish deluge is essentially when Poland is getting like massacred,
yeah.
the Polish king, in order to get the great elector Frederick William on side, he basically gives Frederick William complete authority over Prussia. Like he doesn't have to swear fealty to the Polish king anymore. That's
right. Yep.
Yeah, that's 1657 or 58, and that's a really important, because from that moment on then, that is because of that moment that Frederick William's grandson is able to become king in Prussia, because even though he's an elector yeah. of Brandenburg, his authorization over Ducal Prussia is so kind of vague and unusual that he's able yeah. to basically proclaim himself king. And then again, he's only able to do that in 1701 because the Holy Roman Emperor wants help against the French because of the War of the Spanish Succession is about to happen. So mm-hmm. that kind of circumstances help the leader of Prussia, or Brandenburg, if you like, become important. And that's almost like a common theme of Prussian history. The chancellor, and in our case, in our war with Bismarck, using the circumstances to his advantage big time, and like really,
yeah.
really bringing Prussia even further out of obscurity and into like exploding onto the world stage.
That is really interesting. Like, but really it comes down to like Bismarck at even from before the Franco-Prussian War. Well, okay, let me back up. I guess in this regard, I'd go backwards.
Sure.
And let me explain that I grew up in Munich. That's probably a good place to start, actually.
Yeah.
and Bavaria, because I did wonder, like, Bavaria, okay, there was a Bavarian king, all right? So why, you know, how did they become part of essentially Prussia after, you know, after the Franco-Prussian War? And how did Württemberg become part of, like, why did they ever agree to this and this and that? But that's already, like, in Munich, my first foray into history was what is the Holocaust and what are Nazis and why was Munich Hitler's favorite city and what does that mean?
Sure.
And then you kind of go backwards to, oh, okay, well, a piece of the puzzle of why World War II happened is because of the way World War I ended. And this is like the reason that Germans are so enthralled with the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles. Like
yeah.
that's just, that goes back. Okay, so World War I, why were Germans so gung-ho to go to war? Well, because of the Franco-Prussian War, because that was a crazy victory and was just, you know, went perfectly for them. And they had a string of victories in the 19th century because of Bismarck and like because of the Prussians and because of Bismarck's policy. So then it comes down to like, well, who is Bismarck? Because after when Napoleon cleans up the Holy Roman Empire, it's like 100, what is it? Like somewhere around 1100 almost autonomous, almost independent, like principalities, bishoprics, counties, dukedoms, and and they might have tariffs, they might have like a coinage, like a common currency, but probably not. They, you know, everybody that can print their own money prints their own money, and yeah, it's just
disgusting.
Yeah, for as far as like if you're a businessman or if you're a merchant or anything, it's just horrible. It's a nightmare of like trying to import and export or do any kind of trade. And that still, I mean, so, you know, fast forward like 50 years, but you still have the German question, I guess, is the big, I don't know what it is in English, but the Kleindeutsche or Großdeutsche, like the big Germany or small Germany solution to the German question. And that is Austria and Prussia going to be one country, or is Austria and Prussia, or is it going to be Germany without Austria or what? And that plays into later World War One, like World War Two, megalomania two, and that whole thing, like you know, Germany and Austria are definitely the two Germans, the two Germanies, and you know, how does that, like, who's gonna do? I mean, I can't even go deep in the weeds on this. Like, I, you know, my understanding isn't that deep, but the Parliament in Frankfurt, you had this, the Prussian part, that was like this German, not the North German Bund, you know, but this other, like this German, because Austria was represented there, and it, like this, like, okay, well, we need some sort of government thing so we can bring it to this pan-Germanic forum, which had no teeth. It's kind of like the EU of, you know, like they didn't have any power to enforce anything, because there was a separate parliament in Vienna and a separate one in Prussia. And, you know, they all sent people to Frankfurt, but what the heck is Frankfurt, you know? Like, it was just so weird. And Bismarck navigated all this. And it all does kind of come back to Bismarck, that, like, I don't know, was he a great chess player? I remember you mentioned it on your show, the Emser Depeche, or Dispatch, I guess, the telegram that is received, but Bismarck gets his hand on it. So there's a story. This story was debunked by a historian. I don't want to feed your listeners fake news, but it's a story I still love, where, according to this story, Bismarck was at a dinner party, basically, when he got the telegraph. And the telegraph is this very, it's still there's certain demands in it. And it's, you know, if you do this, we'll, you know, that we would see that as an act of aggression and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
But you'll often hear that the Emser Dispatch is, or that, you know, the telegram was, a couple of words were omitted, maybe, before he let it be published. That's not true. It was like two-thirds were cut out. Two-thirds were cut out. It was like, and so according to the story, Bismarck's sitting around the dinner table with his buddies, and he's like, and they're just in a bad mood, political something, just a bad mood happening. And they're sitting around the dinner table going, you know, and Bismarck's like, well, what if we cross this? Now it sounds like this. And they read it. And finally he didn't, you know, he kept crossing stuff out until they were all just like laughing around the table, like, oh, that's awesome. Print that. And okay. So this story was debunked, but still I love it. Cause it's like, you could see that happening in a way, that they're like, okay, that's perfect. You know, let's see what the French think of that. And, you know, sure enough, that, like, the French declared war, you know, like that was exactly the intent, and checkmate. And, you know, that's exactly what they wanted. There's another story that I think foreshadows the Franco-Prussian War.
Oh, okay.
Which I don't know if you mentioned this. So did you talk about, he was in a duel?
No, I didn't know about the duel. I heard about it, but I didn't include, like, it because I didn't find anything on it.
Yeah. So I'm not surprised. I'm not saying you should have mentioned it, because there's very famous historians that when they wrote their books on Bismarck, they didn't even bring it up. Like, so some people think that this is not important at all. But at the time it was reported in the media across, like, in Bavaria, Prussia, all the different places. And I think the story foreshadows the way that he made France declare war on Prussia. I think it shows a little bit about Bismarck's personality. And
okay,
like, who was Bismarck? Like, that's a hard question to even answer, because he's a Junker, he's a rural nobility, and yet he created the first social welfare state in Germany, and it's a very famous one, you know. So he was a defender of the Protestants, except for when he worked with the Catholics, you know, against the socialists, and, like, you know, he's just a super good chess player. But duels, I gotta admit, like, duels, and I kind of first started reading about Austrian like Austrian duels, like Austro-Hungarian era duels. This was definitely a Prussian thing too. So, you know, the Prussian
time,
and their honor and blah, blah, blah. Like, there's a crazy number. So in 1882 to 1912, there was 2000, over 2000 recorded duels. Like, that's the police record. So times that by three to get a real number of how many duels happened that weren't reported, you know. And you notice just like, oh, wow, no, this was a thing, especially if your nobility, which Bismarck was. And, you know, Bismarck kept getting higher and higher ranking nobility, but he started off as a rural, you know, Junker, like a nobleman. But OK, so back in 1852, and there's a lot of funny stories about this duel, like how it happened, why it happened. And basically, he had a conservative politician rival named Georg von Vincke. Von Vincke was another, like, he was a Junker. He had the same rural background. He had, the rural nobility background. He was the same person as Bismarck. And maybe, he was just, they hated each other, probably because they reflected each other. There's this funny incident that was reported in the newspapers that this all comes back to a cigar and Bismarck smoking. Like, there was, it's bizarre. Like, the first, the newspaper said that only the Viennese, like the royal, like the representatives of the royal court, would smoke cigars. No one else would light up in the parliament or in the common rooms. But Bismarck looked over at the Austrians and said, well, if they're smoking a cigar, and he lit up a cigar. And this, that's typical Bismarck. I can buy that. What the newspapers now reported to various degrees was, now you have you even have liberal non-smokers lighting up cigars in like a protest against the Austrians in this case, or, you know, like, just like it's suddenly become a statement of like who's smoking and who's not. And it's like just weird thing, but that's not actually what the duel was about, because Vincke got mad about like, who is this guy lighting up in the, so Bismarck said some things that were definitely agitating and definitely insulting. And now the newspapers disagree who even challenged the other person. But one person has von Vincke like defending himself, like he had no choice. He was backed into a corner. His honor demanded, like he challenged Bismarck to a duel, of course.
Sure,
And that was like, and every, many, many people, like Bismarck in his correspondence was like, can I get out of this? Is this like, I gone too far? We see like similar stories with Abraham Lincoln, like, oh, shoot, like now we're actually going to shoot at each other. And Bismarck's like asking his friend, and they're like, no, at this point, like, and they're like, hey, and best case scenario, we get rid of an opposition politician in parliament, which is like, whoa, that's crazy. That's one way to solve your politics. So Bismarck later writes that he understood that von Vincke had to challenge him. And when I read that, I'm like, wow, did he learn a lesson there, to where if he knew that if he edits the Emser telegram, that France would, like Napoleon III would have no choice but to declare war, which like von Vincke was France in this case. Exactly. Like he just had to, and Bismarck was ready. Like they were both fencers, of course, because they're like Prussian nobility. And but then they went to pistols, and you know, they both missed. There's the rumor that they were both handed like unloaded pistols. Bismarck later writes that he found it disappointing that suddenly the whole excitement had gone down. Like, he's like, as I looked through the smoke and saw von Vincke still standing, I was disappointed that the fight was over. I'm like, oh my God, like he wanted to kill him. And the people that was like, well, there wasn't even a doctor present, the whole thing was just a show of honor. The people that, and they're like, no, Bismarck was disturbed, like before and right after. And he definitely thought it was a real duel. So you're like, oh, wow, that's kind of like he played von Vincke to the same way he later, like 20 years later, almost would play France.
Yeah.
I love that story for that, you know.
Oh, big time. It's really indicative of his character, though, isn't it? Like,
yes.
Like you said, like 20 years beforehand, it's like he's already doing things that he would later do, but on a much wider scale, except instead of von Vincke, it was Napoleon III. Like, it's mad, but obviously he understood even then how to work people.
Oh, yeah. And so here's a weird thing. When he started the war with Austria and won that one, there was a big part that said, no, you need to keep on going. You need to march all the way to Vienna. You need to make them pay, make them, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Bismarck backed down and was like, nope, we're going to have no secession. I mean, Austria had secession. They had to give up their claim on Schleswig-Holstein. They had to give up Venice and, you know, this and that. But they didn't give up anything to Prussia. And Bismarck was like, that's what we wanted. That's enough. And we, because of this, we definitely have all the say in the German politics now and blah, blah, blah. This is enough. Later, if he would have listened to his own advice, like something changed when they went to war with France. Like they were right out. I mean, they were in Versailles. They were right outside Paris shooting at Paris. And it was like, I wonder if they just would have backed off and then they demanded Alsace-Lorraine. And it's like, well, I wonder if they just would have, if they would have treated France, they would have treated the way they treated Austria.
I know. Yeah. This whole load of what ifs wrapped up with that.
Yeah. That's where my interest goes, like, well, then we got, then World War One, then World War Two, then, you know, cause it's like, you know, Alsace-Lorraine was this big deal. And then Versailles, like the second Reich, the Second Empire was founded it wasn't the Hall of Mirrors, right? But in any case, in Versailles, like, what is this Germans' fascination of founding their empires in Paris? Like,
yeah.
Don't you guys got a half dozen German capitals you could go to? Like, it's just, weird.
It was symbolic with Versailles, I think, because of Louis XIV as well. And looking at him now, because Louis XIV is kind of, we just finished at the time this whole big special comes out, this whole big remastered project, our episode on the Franco-Dutch War will be finished, but Louis XIV's threat to Germany, like the German states, they could either ally with him or against him, but he was a big threat to their sovereignty individually. So maybe it was a kind of a middle finger to what Louis XIV had done in the past, perhaps.
Clearly, but it was like, don't you have your own?
Yeah.
I mean, well, the thing is, I always thought it was interesting that, like, I've been to Versailles as a tourist and looked at that whole thing, but I've also been to four perfect copies of Versailles, not with the extra wings that Louis built and all this and that, but the basic, the middle structure, there's one, but Karlsruhe, you know, in Baden-Württemberg, Louis II of Bavaria built one, Nymphenburg, which is on an island. It's like, I built it, and they're just replicas of Versailles, but they're like, but my Versailles is on an island in this lake, you know? And I'm just like, what is their fascination? Like, leave it alone, you know, build your own. So now it's like, there's the Hall of Mirrors. That's where that took place, which means, you know, now there's that famous picture of, you know, of like Hitler and them standing at Versailles. And it's like, yeah, that's not, I mean, the propaganda from later generations, it all comes back to these events, like these chain of events. So, that's why it's so important. Like, that's why the Franco-Prussian War was so crucial to understanding what happened in the 20th century.
Why I think most histories of basically the 20th century, if they want to explain the First and Second World Wars, they nearly always start from 1870 or 1871, rather.
Yeah.
And, like, you really can't do it. In a way, you have to go back before then. And
well, yeah, my example is, like, if you want to know alternative history where none of those things happened, that's where Bismarck treated Paris the way he treated Vienna.
Yeah.
Just 5 years prior. Five years later, he's, you know, instead of saying, no, we're not going to march to Vienna, we're going to deal with them now on equal-ish terms. Like later, he's like, nope, let's march to Paris. Let's shoot at Paris while we're occupying Versailles and we're going to demand Alsace-Lorraine. And it's just like, ooh, that's, where's the logic? Like, you know, 5 years earlier, you said the opposite thing, but
I know.
But also flip-flopping, like being opportunistic is bad as also.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At the core of Bismarck too. That's, yeah, so again, okay, that's typical Bismarck then. It had, yeah, that's the only way it could have happened.
I think it's interesting what you said about the duel as well, and just the sense of honor in the Prussian kind of the Prussian nobility and the Junker class. They were essentially like the warrior class, but they weren't warriors anymore, kind of thing. I just think that's interesting because of my dissertation that looked at the code of honor. But it was in the case of Britain, it looked very much at national honor, and everyone at the time of the First World War, which is interesting because it was traced up to 1912 in your example there of all the Prussian duels, but up to the First World War, pretty much everyone who got involved, national honor was used in some way. In Britain's case, Britain's was probably the most blatant. And that's why I found it the most interesting. It was also all their sources were in English, so it was easier to research. Yeah. But the fact that, like,
I can see parallels there. Yeah, oh, yeah, like Prussian, because Austria and Prussian especially, like, nobility meant something. And if you actually read about, because I was like, well, what did von Vincke, or what did Bismarck actually say that von Vincke found himself so in a corner that he's like, well, we're going to duel it out. Mm-hmm. And basically, I mean, he insulted him left and right for a decade about his, the way he talks in parliament, the way, you know, his stance and that he has no stance and just like all this this political trash talk.
Sure.
But what it actually came down to, the reason he, you know, figuratively pulled off the glove was, or the gauntlet, was that he questioned his rank. He questioned his behavior as a Junker, like as a nobleman.
Right.
He said, this is not the way a nobleman behaves. I question whether he even should be considered as such.
Oh.
That, and I bet that is that would drop the ball in England, the UK, like in those noble circles too.
Sure, if you're, yeah.
It's like, oh, you question my position, my stat, my cultural status. That goes too far. Like,
yeah.
That's hard for us to relate to because I'm like, you can call me white trash all day. Like, that's fine. You know, go for it, dude. But yeah, they're like, what? You say I shouldn't have my inheritance. Like, I'm not worthy of it. No, them's fighting words.
Yeah.
Like, that's it.
Big time, because actually dueling was outlawed in Britain by 1852, I think it was.
Prussia too. Prussia was legal the whole time. Like, right. I don't even... Yeah.
It's funny, it was legal, but it still happened. Like, in the UK, they never really did it, and duels came to be kind of looked down upon from about the 1850s in Britain. There was still the national honor thing, but...
Yeah.
And kind of transferred from the person to the nation, if you like, whereas...
I can tell you that Austria was... did not give up that practice easy. Prussia, I guess, the same, but Austria is definitely known for, you know, in World War One, when you all see them wearing that cavalry, the cavalry hats, like,
of course,
the cavalry equals the, you know, they're samurai. They're, you know, that's their warrior class. They would never, you see them getting into Mercedes instead of horses, but still they got that hat on. That goes along with that. That's where dueling, you know, they go hand in hand.
Of
like
course.
They have that status. If you insult that status or, you know, then that's, it's out. Mm. Sabers out, guns drawn. Here we go.
Yeah. So. Like, I don't want to make this a podcast about national honor, but I just found it so interesting. It was like, the more I looked into it, the more examples I found. And even like in the 19th century as well, like it dates pretty far back, obviously before that. But even in the stuff I was looking at in the 1600s, it was seen as like, with the likes of Charles II of Britain in the 1660s, like he kind of saw it. National honor was used, but also the honor of a person. It was just very like there's a big history there, which is obvious because that's why I find it so interesting. But I think the way it carries on, and it's kind of like a background thing that historians haven't looked at as much as I think they should have to kind of get a real grasp of the way people really thought back then. Because that's why the First World War, or even the Franco-Prussian War, the fact that Bismarck used the war as a tool of diplomacy, but in the First World War it was kind of like, no one really wanted it, but they felt like it had to happen because they felt pushed into that kind of situation. And I think national honor is a big part of that, and it's not appreciated enough.
you know, peeling back the onion layers of Bismarck, I think one thing you see is what makes Bismarck a good chess player. And I might step out on the thin ice here. This is kind of my opinion, but I think what makes Bismarck so interesting is that he understood complex things like the Prussian nobility honor system, or even the international honor system. And that was just one more tool in his repertoire of how to get things done.
And
if you think about it, like, that's crazy, because is. You know, so he's just like, okay, so I'm going to insult this person to the point where he needs to, you know, he's going to want a duel, or I'm going to make it, you know, I'm going to take the, like, mince the Kaiser's words so much that it makes France, like, Napoleon has no choice but to defend his honor.
And
that's the kind of thing where, yeah, if I mean, you can be goaded into war like that. Like, that's but to Bismarck, he's just a person that understood that at all times. He was a politician for so long at that point, but was the underdog for so long. He just understood how things work that by the Franco-Prussian War, he had another 20 years of, like, unifying Germany and doing great things.
I think as well, the fact that, I mean, I've always, if I could go back and do it again, and I think even in the future, this great podcast ground, even for the period of the time that Bismarck was chancellor, from 64 to 1890, pretty much, he was at the helm of first Prussia and then Germany. And I think there's so much there, everything from the scramble for Africa to the Bulgarian crisis in the Balkans to the Russo-Turkish War, like, so much stuff happens. And I think Bismarck's role in the center of it, I think that's why, because when people started listening to the podcast, they discovered pretty early that I was, I think obsessed is a strong term, but I like to say I'm a big fan of his. But I think he just epitomizes this podcast so well, because not only did he know how to make diplomacy fail to his benefit, but he also knew his opponents well enough to know when he could push the issue and still get what he wanted. And I think that was the matter. That's the mark of a true kind of master, really. Mm-hmm.
In Munich, again, there's the residence. The Bavarian king lived, but, you know, he would have guests and whatever when the Prussians came by or Austrians came by. But there was these murals of these, because Bavarians were the traditional allies of the French.
Sure.
Even if it was against the Austrians or against a different German, especially against the Austrians, maybe. Like, that's the, but you know, and the Franco-Prussian War is, like, the French felt betrayed because the Bavarians fought with the Prussians and all of this. And in retrospect, that may be overlooked a lot, because people are like, well, obviously the Bavarians fought with the Prussians against France because, well, they, you know, we can't imagine it any other way, because it was just a German state when World War I was fought, and it was a German state when World War II was fought. But before 1871, Bavaria was at odds with, you know, they had their hat in the mix. They tried to have more influence and be autonomous and this and that. And they were one of the bigger states. Like, Austria-Hungary is its own can of worms, but they were bigger than Prussia. They were bigger than Württemberg. And just so, yep, Prussia's still, it's almost an afterthought. Like, oh, yeah, of course we're going to annex Bavaria and Württemberg. You know, who's going to stop us?
I know. It's mad. Yeah. The role Bavaria plays actually is an interesting part as well, because in my in my background studying with Louis XIV, just as he was there for so long, he almost establishes the French relationship with Bavaria right up to the point of the War of the Spanish Succession in 1702, when it actually breaks out. The Allies against France, they've all these plans, a kind of disgruntled Bavarian elector, if you like. When he doesn't get what he wants in Italy, he sides with Louis XIV, and this throws all the Allied plans out of whack. And it's only it's only with the Battle of Blenheim, then the famous Allied victory, that Bavaria is kind of cowed then, and it has to kind of be like, all right, I'm sorry, kind of thing. But it's very interesting how Bavaria did pop up. But, like, in the 30 Years' War, Bavaria was a very strong Maximilian of Bavaria. The story of him during the 30 Years' War, because he was one of the few electors that stayed in place during the entirety of the conflict, and he was utterly loyal to the emperor. And if not for Bavaria, the Habsburg cause would have failed much earlier than it did. So I found it interesting, the flip-flop. Louis XIV plays a very important role in changing Bavaria around, basically offering the Bavarians giving the Bavarians an offer they couldn't refuse, pretty much.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, the 30 Years' War is because Bavaria is staunchly Catholic. Bismarck especially was being anti-Catholic for the Lutheran cause kind of in Prussia. And then, you know, and the Catholics even formed their own party. Like that's something I can't wait to get to, actually, is the development of the Zentrum party and then kind of their roots of what's happening today in Germany, which is just that, again, like Zentrum is the opposition to Bismarck. That is why that's the Catholic, that's why they existed. Like if right. Bismarck wasn't there, there would be no Catholic party to oppose him. It's just like, you know, but then of course he cooperates with Zentrum against the socialists. And so, yeah, of course, you know, he cooperates with Catholic Bavaria against the, it all comes together. It's all kind of neat how that works out.
Bismarck's penchant for strategically teaming up with his allies. And you could say that enough, like in the case of the Franco-Prussian War, I always found it interesting the fact that he was able to not offend Austria in, because it was only 4 years after the Austro-Prussian War that he makes war on France. And I always found it interesting that he was able to do that and not worry about Vienna coming up from the south to attack him. But I mean, aside from the fact that Austria was preoccupied with its Hungarian problem by that point,
yeah,
I think they didn't really have the stomach for another war, especially against Prussia after their loss at Sadowa, I think was a huge national kind of catastrophe for Austria. So they probably didn't have the stomach for it, but even the diplomatic threat they could have posed and how Napoleon III didn't really make use of what Austria could have done potentially for like even just to pull the Germans that they would later become in different directions. Do you think maybe there was just a reluctance to, from like your kind of experience growing up or whatever, do you think there was a reluctance on the Austrian part to attack the Prussians on behalf of France, say?
That's a good question, because I think Bismarck had this famous balancing game, but this is too early to, like, the classic balance of power in Europe, like Bismarck does that later. So at this point, and at that point, like Austria was an ally, if anything. It was like, look, we got these against France and the UK, and that's like towards the end of his life sort of thing. But still, that's weird that happened. And I wonder if, Was he so generous after the Prussian-Austrian War? Is that why he was so generous? Because he knew he would, in a very short period of time, need them to be neutral or friendly towards them against the French?
Yeah.
That's kind of like, I don't know, because I think that's like, how much faith do you put into Bismarck as the chess player? Like, did he see that far ahead? Yeah. Because there's all kinds of evidence that I could throw at you that says, well, no, he was really just an opportunist.
Yeah.
And year to year was like, there was no long-term strategy, or he would have done things differently. Yeah. It's interesting that he was so generous with Austria 5 years before.
Yeah.
And before the war with Austria, I mean, I guess the war settled it. Like, it's just so weird how the war settled it, because before it was fighting tooth and nail to what could Prussia do, what could, like the cigar thing, the Austrian guy is going to light a cigar in Parliament, so I'm going to light a cigar in Parliament. And it's just weird, this weird petty nitpicking back and forth to, Austria is not going to do anything while we attack France. Like, that's very strange. But, you know, they beat them soundly. It was much shorter. Like, it's also known as the 7 Weeks War, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, they beat them so much better than they thought they were going to, even. And then they said, okay, like, that's not going to happen again. So maybe that was just enough. That, like, they're not going to try this anytime soon. Like, we're good. Yeah, no, good question. Like, I can't say definitively, like, what Austria was thinking or what Prussia knew about Austria to make them not worry about him. But
sure, because we could look ahead and say, like, in the Prussia-Danish War, say in 64, right, the idea that Bismarck wasn't always a German nationalist for a long time. He didn't want Prussia to, because he thought that in the unified Germany, Prussia would have a reduced say in kind of what went on. And I'm not entirely sure at the exact point that he became converted to that cause, probably about the point that he realized you could have it both ways. You could have a unified Germany with Prussia at its head kind of thing.
I think that is what changed his mind when that happened is the question. Yes.
Yes. Like, yeah. But yeah. I find it interesting that, because we say, oh, how far ahead could he have known? But if you think about it with the war with Austria, that was necessary to kind of clear up the German dualism argument. Like, would it be Vienna? Would it be Berlin kind of thing? After that, after 1866, or even during that war, he must have known in order to complete the job, to make all of Germany unified, there would have to be an existential threat. And Bismarck, throughout his career as well, he'd always been against the idea of a war with Russia. And he would have known Napoleon III's character well enough, and the sense that, like, the trouble his regime was in, even by the mid-60s, with the failed war in Mexico that the French forces tried to pursue under Napoleon III's name. Like, this is a lot of maybes. But I just, in my head, it makes sense that Bismarck would see the most logical way. Like, he'd used war as a tool so far. I mean, why not use it again against France? And if you're not going to use it to, like, you're not going to use the Russian threat, which probably, arguably, might have been more traditional, to use the threat of a Russian invasion, and maybe more convincing to the other German states as well. But I suppose if he wanted the ones nearer the Rhine, or, like, further down to the south, southwest, that would have been under more direct threat, especially Bavaria. Maybe he thought that the French threat would be more kind of handier to provoke to suit his circumstances. So this is basically a roundabout way of me saying that I think he must have looked ahead to an extent, because yes, he was definitely an opportunist, but if he hadn't expected France to declare war, then I think he would have been a lot harder than Austria than he was. And I think the fact that he was hard on France, I think, like, arguably some people say, oh, it was because of his generals, oh, they wanted a buffer between, but, like, obviously it was a terrible idea in retrospect. But I think had he not thought the job was done, he would have gone further against Austria and kind of vassalized it almost, if he'd wanted to.
And Bismarck, so I do know that he was very outspoken about, no, like, you know, I'm totally paraphrasing, but he was very, like, strict about, like, no, like, the Austrians are our brothers, we need to, like, preserve their, like, let them preserve their honor in this war, kind of thing.
Sure.
Like, he really did fight his generals, and that's why I think, yeah, a lot of people think that he might have given in to his generals when he then attacked Paris. But yeah, my big question is, like, okay, well, how, you know, why did he want Alsace-Lorraine, really? Like, in his mind, personally, privately, like, he kept diaries and stuff. There must be somebody that has written a book on that. But, like, that area, okay, sure, it's economically good. It'd be a buffer. It would take away, you know, France's defensive capability to some degree. And it's and Alsace-Lorraine goes way back. Like, I already started talking about it on the History of Germany. And that was, like, way back in the 9th century. So Alsace-Lorraine goes way back to why Germans might consider it German and French certainly consider it French. So there's just so many things. Like, was he really being opportunistic? Because it doesn't, like, Bismarck himself, I don't think, would do something just because honor demands it. Like, I think he'd be smarter than that and somehow work around it and even, you know, twist words. And he was just a clever enough person to say, yeah, we don't want Alsace Lorraine for ideological reasons. Like, we want,
you know,
like, no, he would have a good reason. But what that was, like, I just don't know. Cause I think that's the difference between, yeah, he wanted to go all the way to Paris to make sure he wanted a complete victory so that that couldn't be argued. And, like, that's exactly the opposite of what he did with Austria.
As well, how much do you know about the kind of the period that came after the Franco-Prussian War? Like, so say from, like, 1871 to about 1890 when Bismarck resigned, kind of thing. Do you know all that much about kind of that period?
The thing that I like then is, like, the social history, like, even to this day, there's, like, the CDU and the SPD, the Social Democrat Party of Germany, and the Christian Democrat.
Yeah.
And that those go back to the Centrum, like I already said, was the Catholics in opposition to Bismarck. They formed their party. And the SPD also was like, OK, well, we want these socialist reform, like this welfare type of reform for workers, and that also formed in Bismarck's time. And that's just kind of interesting to note. So, like I've been to Hamburg, and the very first, some of the very oldest, like, socialist type housing. And because everybody had their own apartment, then they started to do all these little side industry jobs, like just making thread or making yarn, or, you know, actually creating some sort of textile. And that created this industrial, like, this micro industrialization that is so unique to Germany almost. Like, Germany's weird in its own way, as far as like how, you know, how they're like industrious and they have all these little family businesses that grow up into be who knows what, like MBB and Mercedes and all these big companies.
Yeah.
But that started, if you look, you know, why is Germany this way? And you start going backwards to answer that question, and you see these workers' quarters in Hamburg that you're like, oh, so did this start to happen because of the SPD? No, Bismarck did this so that he just took the wind out of the sails of the socialists. Mm. You know, he built the first welfare state, gave a social net, gave social guarantees in order that the communist was later, but the order that the socialist could not gain traction. That's kind of, I don't know a lot about his later life. He died early enough that he didn't have to see what happened as far as like World War I. Like, so Ludendorff, we went to Hralitz-Kralovy, you know, 1866 battle. And who's the general in charge? Ludendorff,
yeah.
And I'm just like, what? Like, same Ludendorff that saw Hitler rise to power? Or, you know, okay, at least Hindenburg did. But the same Ludendorff that was in World War I 50 years later? Like, that's insane. German vampires, I tell you. Like, so, yeah, I mean, it is a generation or two difference, but no, they're so connected. Like, one event, one war leads into the other. You know, the next generation forgets how bad war is and they want it again. And it's just like, wow.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that a forgotten thing, you touched on it there about the social aspects, but the fact that it's doubly impressive because while Bismarck was balancing things internationally for those two decades, he was balancing things domestically at home.
Oh, yeah.
And to a great extent, the latter was more stressful to him, and more of his resignation, threats and complaints of stomach problems before promptly downing a whole load of alcohol and smoking a load of cigars.
Yeah.
A load of those complaints and threats to resign came from the problems he was having with getting politicians on side.
And especially in later life, I always thought his threats to resign was also just always a ploy.
Yes.
Like, he knew that it would never be accepted. He knew that like, it's throwing a hissy fit.
Yeah,
like, if we
is.
Don't, you know, it if we're is. Not doing this, or if you don't pass this bill, I'm going to resign.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, oh, no, don't go that far. We need your advice for Tanzania or something.
Yes.
Tsingtao, you know, like, what the? Definitely domestically, like, he just set his will through in so many different ways. Like, he was just amazing. And he's a cult of personality before it existed. He was a benevolent dictator before it. I mean, he had so much power in a way by the end of his life that you could really say he scratched together the state of Germany, the second German Empire, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
That they lost in World War I. But he scratched it together just through his pure will and, okay, opportunism, yes, but really, like, tactics in parliament, like his tactics with other politicians and his strategy and everything. There was definitely a force of will there that if you take him out of the equation, like, that's the great man of history kind of theory. But in Bismarck's case, it's like hard to say that that's not true. Like, just pull Bismarck away, you'd be like, oh no, because Germany was, you know, dozens of like semi-autonomous states. And Habsburgs had possessions way up in the northwest somewhere, almost to the Netherlands, and and which were obviously Austrian at one point in history, and you know, all that stuff. And they're just saying, like, yeah, no, like, okay, we fight a war with you. Now we take all this. Next time, another little war, and we take the southern German states. And it's like, no, that was all the way he wanted the wars run, the way he needed them declared, not just the Franco-Prussian, but also with the Austrians and everything. You got to say, like, no, if you pluck this one man out of the 19th century, like, all kinds of things are different.
Oh, big time.
He's really a fascinating character to look at. And I'm not really a conservative. I don't like agree with him politically, but it's like, yeah, no, this guy is just fascinating. Like, he had such an impact.
I think the best counterpart that I can find is Metternich, who was head of Austria pretty much from the end of the Napoleonic War and like negotiating then in the Congress of Vienna. From then until the revolutions of 1848, Metternich was essentially at the head of Austria. And I think that was really the last gasp of Habsburg kind of power projection. It was part of the Holy Alliance with Prussia and Russia as well. But I think like that, someone like Metternich and someone like Bismarck, they really do provide a pretty strong case for the great man in history idea, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, Metternich, the Austrians overall, like, I love the story of the Habsburgs, but clearly, I mean, it took them 500 years to even become emperors, and there was no single, it's a whole different thing. Bismarck is like, who is this random rural, and people have written book on just the young Bismarck and his childhood, and like, why wasn't he just a typical Junker? Because his mom was metropolitan, his mom wanted him to actually, like, learn a trade, and you know, his dad was just like typical Prussian, you know, landholder. Like, you know, so, like, you see in his childhood these being torn into different directions and being sent off for education and being sent off to Berlin and you know, this and that.
Sure.
And definitely just an interesting character that it's hard to do justice, even if your podcast was another 2 hours.
Yeah.
Well,
we're gonna wrap this up now because it's been going for an hour. But before we do, is there any kind of closing thoughts you'd kind of like to share just on Bismarck or maybe the importance of the Franco-Prussian War in general?
Yeah, again, Franco-Prussian War, this is my whole interest in it was because you got the Franco-Prussian War, Alsace-Lorraine, it was so easy to defeat France. When you see the outbreak of World War One and you see these streams of Germans just marching like gleefully with flowers in their helmets, you know, what was it called? It was like the springtime enjoyment, or I forget what they call it, but like they're off in we're off to war and it's like a celebratory thing. And then they get slaughtered by the thousands and tens of thousands. That is, they all had in their mind, like, we're off to Bismarck's Franco-Prussian War.
Yeah.
In fact, we got, what's his name?
Ludendorff, yeah.
Ludendorff, yeah, and Hindenburg, and, you know, they're still around. They remember the good old days. You know, here we go.
Yeah.
And it was no such thing.
No.
And Hitler, like, mimicking, you know, going off to Versailles and you know, making them sign this thing in the Hall of Mirrors was like, it's revenge for World War One, but it's also mimicking Bismarck signing the, you know, founding the Second Reich. Now Hitler's founding the Third Reich. Okay. Mm. But you know, in the making Versailles a part of that. And it's just like the way that the Franco-Prussian War, World War One and World War Two, the fact that they're these distorted echoes in history that, oh, that's good. That's a Travis Dow trademark. Quote, no, but seriously, like World War One and World War Two, from the German perspective, it's like well, let's try to do it again. Oh, we failed. Well, let's try to do it again. Oh, we failed. You know, and World War Two was so much like, well, here's everything that we did wrong in World War One. If we changed it up, we would be just like, it would be just like the Franco-Prussian War again. Except that it wasn't, you know, like those two, the greatest wars in at least in European history is just like, yeah, I mean, the Germans just looked to the Franco-Prussian War.
They did.
And we're like, oh, let's go get Strasbourg back. Let's go, you know, that's our city. Let's go take it back. So it's hard to overstate the Franco-Prussian War, actually, in summary. Like, it's one of those wars that really should be looked at. And, of course, you look at it for about 2 seconds and you go, oh, well, this is Bismarck's. They just fell into his trap and his plan. And the whole world seemed to follow Bismarck's will in 1870. So
I think
crazy, interesting.
As a war to start one's podcast series with, which I did like 5 years ago, the Franco-Prussian War always interested me because of the person of Bismarck mainly, but also because, like you said, the hard to measure really impact it had on world history, really.
Yes.
I think it was a good place to start, and I think if I was to do When Diplomacy Fails over again, I would start with the Franco-Prussian War as my first episode.
Yeah, definitely gets my approval for a way to start a podcast, and it's great to be a part of the beginning of your Extranza Palooza, whatever you got going on here in the next couple months.
Yeah.
I wish you the best in that. I hope you pull that off. It's going to be pretty epic. I can't wait. So,
thanks very much, Travis. And thanks for coming on. Before we get out of here, is there any plugs you'd like to do to remind people where to go to find you?
You know what? Long story short, go to podcastnick.com. That's podcastnik. There's more than a half dozen feeds there. But history of Germany is obviously the one that's most related to this.
Sure.
I did talk about East Germany now and then. I'm going to Germany in October to do a live show for my German-American show, but also the history of Germany. Like, it'll be a crossover. So I don't even know what I'll talk about, like the Berlin Airlift or the Marshall Plan or something that's, you know, we have in common. Not so much war, but that's not so nice.
Diplomacy but, succeeding in those cases.
Yeah, exactly. Diplomacy succeed. When diplomacy succeeds is, you know, when I'm in front of an audience of Germans, let's go with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that'll be really great. So yeah, history of Germany, I think your listeners might enjoy also, but
cool.
There's plenty other. Bohemian was a passion, so. I lived in Prague for 10 years, and I just love telling stories about Prague. So definitely good stuff.
Right, cool. Well, thanks again for coming on, Travis, and thanks for being such a tolerant and knowledgeable guest.
Well, yeah. Hey, thanks for having me on. It's an honor, and anytime. Bismarck, we can talk Bismarck. You can bring me on for other reasons, but anytime you want to talk Bismarck, sure. Just we can do that.
All right, man. Sounds good.
Yep.
All right, you made it at the other end. What did you think of it? Did you enjoy it? Do you think I spoke well? Do you think I rambled well? Of course I did. I think I noticed, and you guys will notice as well, from the variation of guests I have on these things, Travis likes to talk. Now, that's not in a bad way at all, but it's funny, in comparison, some of the guests I have, I mean, the likes of Benjamin Ashwell, he's very kind of, he lets me speak and then he speaks, or say, this is all kind of a bit of a spoiler, but if you listen to the end of this episode, you deserve a bit of spoilers. So on episode 3, I'll have Mark Painter from the History of the 20th Century, and he doesn't really say anything unless he's kind of spoken to. Stephen Guerra is kind of the same. Benjamin Jacobs is also sort of the same. It's hard to, I don't know, I'm not going to say it's hard to judge because I'm not going to judge anyone, but it's interesting. There we go. Just people's different conversational styles. Some people are dying to get words out, as much words as they can possibly produce. Other people kind of just sit there with a kind of expectant tone and just kind of wait until they have an audio bomb to drop on you. So yeah, it's nice to have different types of guests on because it changes things up and makes it interesting. So I hope you enjoyed Travis's considerable contribution today as the very first guest on the collaboration episodes. If you're scared off from them because of this, I'll basically just blame him. So it's kind of handy in that way. I'm sure he won't mind. Probably is all his fault anyway. These things generally are. But yeah, thanks very much again to Travis. Remember, you can find him, Podcast Nick, that's podcastnik.com. For everything else, wdfpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, guys. And I will see you all soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.